About the term, get it going?
Yeah.
Kelly, you got something?
Pardon me, I started.
Started.
Yes.
Skirts up. All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Robert N. Davis presiding. All who have business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I'm Chief Judge Davis. To my right is Judge Greenberg. To my left is Judge Allen. We're here today in the matter of Cornell against Wilkie, docket number 15-3191E. Presently before the court is intervener Bobby S. Moberly, the veterans, application for an award of attorney fees and expenses pursuant to the Equal Access to Justice Act. The secretary challenges Mr. Moberly's application, contending that he is not a prevailing party and that the secretary's position was substantially justified. Today, we will consider whether the context of a simultaneously contested claim, the court had jurisdiction to issue a bench order precluding the secretary from recouping a payment made to Mr. Moberly, whether that announcement and the confirmatory passage in the court's December 12, 2016 opinion altered the legal relationship between Mr. Moberly and the secretary in such a manner as to make him a prevailing party, and whether the secretary's position on recoupment of the payment to intervener Moberly during the appeal to this court was substantially justified. Would counsel for both parties, for all parties, please note your appearance for the record.
Can I please support Ms. Carpenter appearing on behalf of Captain Cornell?
Okay, thank you.
Doug Brzezinski appearing for Mr. Moberly.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. For the Secretary, Mark Gore, and to my right at counsel's table is Deputy Chief Counsel Richard Daly.
Thank you all. Are all parties ready to proceed? Okay. As you all have been informed, the intervener and the secretary will each have 30 minutes to present your respective arguments. The appellant will have 10 minutes following the intervener, and the intervener may reserve time for rebuttal. Do you have?
Yes, Your Honor, I've reserved 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Very good. Thank you. Mr. Brzezinski, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. As an introductory housekeeping matter, I have prepared a listing of the cases that I may rely upon in my oral argument today that were recently discovered, and I've offered them to the clerk and the other side if it would be of assistance so we're not all writing all the citations down as we proceed. I'd be happy to.
What do you mean by recently discovered?
In response to the court's specific questions.
Why didn't you submit it before today? When was that order issued?
I didn't have the entire list completed until the last few days. I'm trying to offer it as an assistance to the court. If it is improper, then I withdraw the request.
No, I'm just asking the reason.
I prepared it when I had my oral argument outline completed, which was yesterday.
Chief Judge.
Okay, any objection?
Is there any, may I, is there any objection to this proceeding from anybody?
Your Honor, while it would seem to be procedurally deficient to submit this at such a late hour, ultimately the Secretary doesn't have any objections so long as the use to which the cases are put is relevant to issues that have previously been discussed by the parties.
Okay. Mr. Rosinski, I'm assuming that these cases all bear on each of the three issues that I've just articulated and that it appear in the court's order.
Yes, Your Honor, that is exactly the purpose. We can do without it. I was just trying to make it more efficient for.
No, we're. If you're trying to be helpful, and if the cases are helpful, then we should. I would think we should.
Yeah, I'm inclined to accept the list, but I don't want to encourage, on the morning of an oral argument, getting something from counsel.
I understand. Your Honor. I apologize if this created more dissidents than.
Could I just ask a question? I mean, is this thing that we're talking about literally a list of cases with citations?
Yes, Your Honor.
So there's no argument in what you're
absolutely
submitting.
Not. It's just a list.
So my view, only speaking for myself, is fine. It's easier than listening to the oral argument and having my law clerk try to write down the citation. The larger issue, and we should probably get going on the merits, I suppose, but the larger issue is not that you have a list of citations, Mr. Rosinski, but I'm assuming those list of citations are not included in your briefs, right?
Right, Your Honor. We haven't briefed this case. We've only submitted the application and the response. So
so I will take that you didn't submit a list of supplemental authorities ahead of time or anything like that, right?
No, because by the time I had completed the list, it would have required a motion. And
so here's the only thing that I would suggest, right? And when years ago, it seemed like you just rolled your eyes at me. That doesn't get very much, so let's just stop for a second. So here's what I would suggest, okay? We actually spend a fair bit of time preparing for oral argument, and I can't be prepared for the oral argument if a party is going to bring up a case or cases that have never been cited before. So it's very helpful that you're going to give us a list of citations, but it doesn't do a lot for me to prepare for oral argument when you're going to be bringing up these cases that are nowhere submitted before. And frankly, it's not fair to the opposing party to do that here. And so, you know, I would suggest that in the future, maybe you think about that, because that's a significant thing.
Yes, Your Honor. I didn't do this to trip up anybody. I do not believe that this would have been necessary if we had fully briefed the case. I was trying to be helpful so that we're not all just scribbling down numbers today. I apologize for any trouble or any impression that I've given the court that I do not understand its position. Again, I apologize for taking up so much of the court's time. I withdraw the list. I will just proceed with my argument. That's
no. What I'd like you to do is to submit the list for our ease of reference. But if there's any lesson here at all, I think you get the point.
I definitely get
right.
The point.
All right, Mr. Block, could you provide that list to the court, please?
Thank you.
Thank you. May proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. In response to the court's three questions, I wish to provide just two overarching principles so that we have this EJIA application in proper context. The intervener should be treated in the same way as any other party in a case, and that's established in the Delta Airlines case. And the second issue is that the purpose is to remove the disincentive for a party from challenging unreasonable government action. And indeed, the challenge here by Mr. Moberly was the unreasonable threat of recoupment after the long and painful journey that his fee took throughout, both before the litigation in the administrative point and during the litigation.
Is there any effort to recoup anything at this point from the department, Mr. Rosinski, to your knowledge?
Not from Mr. Moberly.
From Mr. Moberly, right.
No, because the court specifically ordered that not occur.
Right.
So the answer to the first question, if we can move to the specific questions on jurisdiction, the answer to that question is it's irrelevant, but yes, the court did have jurisdiction. The key point here is that this case is final. The secretary did not appeal either the case or the specific order, and it's a final judgment, which according to Nevada v. U.S. puts an end to the cause of action for any ground whatever. So there's also cases in this court, Blue v. Wilkie and Dillon v. Brown. There's no relitigation of the merits by the EJIA decision maker. So even if you reach this issue, which I don't believe there's authority for you to do, there was proper jurisdiction. Mr. Moberly filed an NOD, which was initially mishandled by the VA, but he did file it, and it was recognized by the merits court as properly filed. That NOD was quote unquote joined in the SOC that was issued with Ms. Cornell's issues. And then the board issued a decision on that combined appeal. And that was the board decision that was before the merits panel. Therefore, under the court's jurisdictional statutes, 38 U.S.C. 7252 and 7261, the court had jurisdiction to review all relevant legal issues. So even if you could get to that decision, the merits court had jurisdiction. And as the secretary had a chance to raise all these issues and did raise them before that court in various filings and did not appeal either jurisdiction generally or the jurisdiction over the order. Secondly, for prevailing party, the answer is yes. Mr. Moberly received the requested relief. I believe it's important to understand what the requested relief was and was not. The requested relief was to remove the threat of future recoupment, which has no end date. The secretary can recoup at any time in the future should he or she again change their mind in this case without the court's order. The secretary...
Well, can you contest that, or could the veteran contest that effort to recoup here?
He could have contested that. That's exactly what he was trying to settle. This is an elderly man who's very, very ill and was completely taken around the block several times on this issue, and he wanted it settled. That's why...
Quiet title. Is that the analogy?
Essentially, he wanted it resolved. And if you will recall... The secretary had paid both parties money, so this isn't the standard simultaneously contested case where they're fighting over one pot of money. There were two pots of money already issued, so who knows what the secretary would have done or could have done, or with the money could have taken it from both parties, could have redone the whole litigation. That is exactly what the relief was requested to put us.
Let me ask you, if I may, Mr. Rosinski, we have your list of cases. You've mentioned four on the list. Are you going to go through each one of these cases and tell us why we should consider these cases as part of your argument?
No, Your Honor. What
are we supposed to do with the ballot? You've given us Delta and Dillon and Blue and Nevada. What are we supposed to do with the rest of this list?
I believe I will touch upon those on it.
You will?
Yes, all right. Honored it.
Then go ahead. go ahead. Continue with your
pursuant
argument.
Pursuant to Cullen v. Gober, this was an excellent result, and Mr. Moberly was the clear winner of this issue. As the only issue for which he was participating. The other issues were Ms. Cornell's issues. Of course, a favorable decision on those benefited Mr. Moberly, but he was there to ensure that regardless of the issues.
Did it change the legal relationship between him and the secretary?
Absolutely. Before the order, the secretary had all the authority he needed to recoup any amount of the benefits from Mr. Moberly at any time. And we have seen, I believe, even in this court, that could be any time, 3 months, 6 months, a year, 10 years. Even if you narrow it down to just relieving that for the period between the hearing and when the merits decision was issued, or indeed in this case, since the merits decision was appealed until the Federal Circuit resolved the case and it wasn't appealed any further, that was of value and a change in the legal relationship. The secretary could not again change his mind or make another decision that now the pawns needed to move around the chessboard in another way. And for the third question, no, they were not substantially justified for a number of reasons, but in particular, there's two parts to the reasonableness. Reasonableness in causing the litigation and reasonableness in the stance during litigation. And as described in McCormick v. Principe, Roanoke River Basin, and Info Science cases, that if you're inconsistent with your policies, that is not substantially justified basis. In this case, they caused the litigation because they had inconsistent compliance with the policies on how to figure this out. They paid the wrong, first of all, they decided a fee was due and it wasn't represented by a counsel. They paid the wrong counsel. And somewhere in the middle of this, they paid him. Then they asked the appellant to make a deal, somehow work it out with him, and forgot to pass the communications back and forth on NODs or SOCs or any of that.
Mr. Rosinski, is it your position that if the department makes a mistake or commits an error, that they can never be substantially justified in pursuing the issue like this?
They can be substantially justified if they have a reason, if they have been consistent in what they're trying to do and inconsistent in their goals.
So they made a mistake. They tried to fix it.
They made multiple mistakes, and to the extent there is a policy on how to fix it, it's not clear because they took three or four different positions with respect to Mr. Moberly. He wasn't eligible, he was eligible, he was paid, and then to hold it over his head that they might again come back and tell him to pay it, those are all inconsistent positions, and if you justify one, you can't justify the other side of the coin. And particularly because the general counsel opinion on this states that the policy of the VA is not to create a debt when it is caused by the VA, when the errors are solely VA's errors. So ultimately, all of this that wasn't to leave Mr. Moberly alone once he had his money is contrary to their policies.
Where is that? Is that on your list? These are cases. You mentioned an opinion of the general counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. This was cited in earlier briefs, in the merit briefs. It's VAOPGC.
We have that already. That's what you're referring to.
Yes, Your Honor.
Something we already have.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, thanks.
So it's inconsistent with the policy to even create any kind of debt against Mr. Moberly, which they did and threatened to do again. So they're not justified, again, on the issue that Mr. Moberly was bringing to remove the threat that, according to this policy, was never supposed to be implemented against him. And yet, in their own emails and in the citations in the previous case, show that they considered it an open issue as long as the issue was open on Ms. Cornell's merits decision. And that would have relied, that would have stayed open until the Supreme Court ruled that they appealed it far enough. That is what we tried to cut off, and that's what we did cut off, is that Mr. Moberly went home from that hearing knowing that they couldn't, he was done with this. And he was, as you remember, Chief Judge, he was there. And he wanted to be there, and he'd be here now if he could. But the point is, it was incredibly important to that man to know that that money was put aside because he was seriously ill, and he didn't have to deal with this anymore. So in sum, the request for attorney's fees should not result in a second litigation. That is NACO v. DOT. And there should be no re-adjudicating an appeal de novo Dillon v. Brown. And that the consistency with the courts or with policy is McCormick, Cullen, and Info Sciences.
You haven't mentioned Commissioner v. Jean, Conley v. Wilkie, Dixon, O'Rourke, Hensley, Eckerhart, and Vaughn Principi. Are you going to deal with those?
Well, Your Honor,
reading from your list.
I can.
I mean, what do you
Jean,
want to do
Jean
with those?
Says that Mr. Moberly fully satisfies the prevailing party because in each case is the must determine if the applicant is a prevailing party by evaluating the degree of success obtained. That is Jean. In this case, as we said, Mr. Moberly got exactly what he wanted as relief. And it is relief because, as the Secretary stated in the contemporaneous email, they disagreed that the issue should be closed or was closed.
Conley v. Wilkie.
To achieve prevailing party status, a litigant must receive some judicial action that changes the legal relationship between the parties. We've talked about that.
Dixon O'Rourke.
A prevailing party to a civil action is one who has, quote, succeeded on any significant issue in litigation which achieves some of the benefit sought in bringing the suit.
Hensley Eckerhart.
I don't see that one at the moment. I will find.
How about Keeley versus Merit System Protection Board?
It is now clear that the position of the United States includes the position taken by the agency at the administrative level. Therefore, the administrative level here was, again, one time he was eligible for it, the other time they paid the other attorney, so it was differing.
All right, I got it. Vaughn versus Principi.
That is a case, I believe, cited in Dixon, or I'm sorry, cited in blue.
So the only one we have left is Hensley.
And I believe that was
finger on that at the moment.
That was referenced, I believe it was cited in another case, and I will do my best to.
That's a Supreme Court case.
Yes, and I believe it was cited in Jean, but I don't have that right here.
Thank you.
With that, I will ask that the court grant the EJIA application in full, and unless there's any other questions, I see my time has expired.
Good. Thank you.
Please the court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Ms. Cornell. Going directly to your questions, we believe that the court does have jurisdiction under its express authority under 7261 to the extent necessary to its decision. Obviously, the panel, after oral argument in this case, thought that it was necessary to the extent of their decision and then incorporated that pronouncement from the bench in their written decision. Obviously, the issue was presented, and 7261 gives this court jurisdiction to decide all relevant questions of law.
Mr. Carpenter, it's always nice to Always nice to see you. So take this question in the spirit it's intended. So what are you doing here this morning? In other words, I'm just struggling to think about sort of the actual concrete interest of Ms. Cornell. I understand the broader interest maybe of, representing veterans, and it's an EJ case, I understand that, but
Ms. Cornell and I discussed this when the petition was filed and made a joint decision that she would not participate. And that decision was consistent until this court issued its three questions. And quite candidly, it was the first question that presented us the most concern, particularly the qualification about the simultaneously contested claim context. Obviously, that was the problem in the underlying merits decision. I was reluctant to try to go down that road because obviously that's not part of this proceeding. But Ms. Cornell takes the view that it is the simultaneously contested proceeding that was not abided by the VA in the first instance. Unbeknownst until literally immediately before oral argument in the merits case, Ms. Cornell was of the understanding, and the parties had litigated in their briefs with the understanding, that there had been no timely notice of disagreement filed by Mr. Moberly. At the 11th hour, the VA disclosed to the court and to the parties that, in fact, there had been a timely notice of disagreement. If that timely notice of disagreement had been recognized, then there would have been no distribution to Ms. Cornell. There would have been a litigation as part and parcel of the process, and then assuming that based upon that notice of disagreement that Mr. Moberly would have persuaded the VA to change their view, then an appeal would have been taken at that time by Ms. Moberly. Ms. Moberly was forced to take an appeal because she got a letter out of the blue months after having received the money and told, settle up with the appellant. She was then faced with the circumstance and hired counsel because the rules, the regulations say, if you don't pay a attorney fee back to a, or excuse me, if you have gotten a fee from a party and you don't return that money upon demand by the VA, that you're subject to losing your accreditation. So she's now between the rock and the proverbial hard place. And because that NOD had not been recognized, she proceeded with her own NOD. And then this court, in the merits case, decided that it was somehow all right to merge that. But it is in that context of the circumstance in which this case arose that Ms. Cornell could in fact have been in the intervener position, and had she prevailed, it is relevant not only to her interest, but to every other practitioner's interest, as to whether or not an intervener does or does not have the right, if they get relief, the relief obtained, that they would be entitled to EJA benefits, when the appeal would have to be taken by an intervener in a case, as opposed to being taken by the appellant.
So what Judge Allen actually preempted my same question to you in the same spirit. Why are you here? But what is the appellant's interest currently in whether or not Mr. Moberly gets attorney fees?
The appellant has no interest in that. There's no question that the appellant has paid the government back.
That has happened.
That happened within 30 days, 60 days of the decision by the Federal Circuit. I believe it was April of last year.
It's good to know, because I was going to go down an ethical track
of that. Well, and that seemed to me to be also a value of us appearing, so that there weren't any, because General Counsel may not be aware of that. That was all done through the Department of Justice after the Federal Circuit argument.
Okay.
And quite candidly, if are not interested in my comments and observations, I'm happy to sit down. I've got an argument tomorrow to prepare for. But it seemed to me that, these questions were questions that were global in nature and applied to the bar, and obviously both Ms. Cornell and myself are members of that bar and are interested parties to that extent in the outcome and disposition of this case.
So I do have one question that you have probably personal knowledge of, in the sense that you represented Ms. Cornell on appeal to the Federal Circuit.
Correct.
And of course, it was the Department of Justice that was representing the United States there, the VA. Was there any discussion, to the extent you can tell us, consistent with some sort of settlement privilege that might exist, about any sort of conditional cross-appeal that the United States might bring in that? What I'm getting at is this, which is that the government won, and so I'm going to be asking Mr. Gore this too, right? So the government won in
here,
right? And so in the abstract, there's always sort of the tree falling in the middle of the woods sort of question about if you actually win, but you win in a way that you think is legally wrong, could you appeal, right?
Mm-hmm.
But here, there actually was an appeal because you appealed.
Yes.
And so in practice, as I understand it, one thing in federal appellate practice that one can do is if you're the prevailing party, not in the aegis sense, but if you've sort of won below, you can say to the appellate court, listen, I'm going to appeal this other issue. I don't want you to decide it if you say I win, but if you say I'm going to lose, then I want you to reach my thing, a conditional cross appeal.
Correct.
In theory, I think the government could have done that with respect to the order that the court issued with respect to Mr. Mobley. Was there any discussion that you can share with us, subject to your ethical responsibilities, of that as part of the Federal Circuit appeal?
There was no such discussion. The issue was not raised. I had it in the back of my mind that it was possible. This was a first for me for an announcement from the bench. I will share with you that I actually have had the experience at the Federal Circuit with an announcement from the bench, so I wasn't completely taken by surprise.
And it wasn't a contempt order? I couldn't resist, Mr. Carpenter.
Ooh. but no, there were no such discussions. I, as I say, anticipated it, but it did not happen. And then at the end of the proceedings, Ms. Cornell and I discussed, obviously, the other options that she had and whether or not it was worth litigating the issue about whether they could or could not create an overpayment. And it was her judgment that she would pay the amount of money. But that seems to me to go to the whole question of what is, in my view, a misuse of recoupment in an ad hoc way, that it happened in the merits and it happened after Ms. Cornell filed her appeal to this case, in which the VA announces its authority to recoup and then holds that recoupment over originally Ms. Cornell's head and then in the litigation over Ms. Moberly's head. I believe the court made the correct decision from the bench to relieve Mr. Moberly from that uncertainty about that obligation. The VA had an opportunity to litigate whether the court had jurisdiction to make that determination, whether in a simultaneously contested claim or not. But clearly that was not what took place. And then the VA, using this ad hoc approach, leaves a party dangling. I'm about to expire in my time here. Can I at least finish the thought?
Finish the thought, please.
And that is that the uncertainty of the circumstance in which there is a threatened recoupment is an issue that will ultimately be decided by this court. There are cases percolating at the lower level, cases that I am involved with that are going to be presenting that issue to this court. But that issue was simply not on the radar. other than the presentation by the intervener that he was placed in this circumstance. And the court acted, I believe, correctly to resolve that.
2 minutes. Mr. Carpenter, I'm actually pleased that you did come in to clarify some of these matters. You might recall at the merits point a while back, one of my concerns was why your client didn't write a check earlier. I am relieved that that's happened now, because that's a question that I had.
Certainly are.
And
just to be clear, there was never any question in Ms. Cornell's mind that if the issue went against her, that she would not, in fact, follow through and repay the money to the VA, which is the source from which she obtained it. Ms. Cornell could have proceeded with further litigation, but obviously that was an unnecessary drain on her attention, and she just decided at the end of the road that if the Federal Circuit did not find merit in the argument, that it was not worth pursuing further.
Okay. Very good. Any other questions, Bill? No. Thank you very much. Mr. Gore, you have 2 additional minutes should you need it. And I also recognize that you're at somewhat a disadvantage in dealing with this list of cases. If you would like to prepare a supplemental response to these cases at the conclusion of all argument, you certainly may, and submit that to the court.
Thank you. Yeah. And good morning to the court, and may it please the court. The court should deny the each application filed by intervener Mr. Bobby Mulberly here, because as the secretary explained in his written EJA response, Mr. Mulberly is not a prevailing party within the meaning of the EJA, and moreover, the secretary's position, both at the administrative stage and in the appellate litigation stage of the instant claim, has been substantially justified throughout. And just looking initially to the issues that the court has raised in its clarifying order, I'll begin with the issue of jurisdiction. It should not be surprising to the court that the secretary's position is that the court did not have jurisdiction to reach the issue of recoupment. That's a downstream and jurisdictionally.
So, but in a colloquial sense, right, whether the court had jurisdiction to do it or not, it did it, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it did it twice, right? It did it from the bench, and it did it in the written order, a written opinion. And as I was discussing with Mr. Carpenter, whether or not the government would have had the ability to appeal if nothing else had happened is a question we don't have to get to, right? In other words, whether having won, so to speak, you can still appeal, right? That's an analytically different, difficult issue. But the fact of the matter is that there was an appeal, and I do understand the VA is in a difficult position, because as I understand it, any appeal requires the at least consent or approval of the Solicitor General's office. But you could have had a conditional cross appeal with respect to the point that the court lacked jurisdiction to enter the order it did, and the VA didn't do that. And then the Federal Circuit's decision became final, which meant our decision was then final. So there is a time when you really can't even go back and contest jurisdiction. I mean, jurisdiction is hard to extinguish, but there is a point in time when finality comes into play.
Yes, Your Honor. And respectfully, I don't think we've reached that point yet. As this court observed clearly in Young versus Shinseki, and citing its previous decision in Jackson versus Shinseki, civil action is not, it's an integrated whole, I believe is the language that the court used, borrowing from the Supreme Court in INS versus Jean. We are simply in a different phase of the same civil action that was pending during the merits phase here. This is just simply another phase of that same civil action, and jurisdiction is an issue that remains in play. And indeed, in Young, this court sua sponte raised the issue of jurisdiction after having issued its mandate with respect to the merits. It was only in the EJA phase that the court first recognized an extant issue with respect to its jurisdiction, and it reached that issue.
So the government's position is that it can It can contest jurisdiction in the context of an EJIA application, even when it chose not to contest that issue on an appeal to the Federal Circuit.
Yes, Your Honor, and respectfully, and I must admit, I am not well versed in the issue of a conditional cross appeal, as you've described it. That's just not an issue that that has crossed my path before. How that notwithstanding, it would seem that any appeal that the Secretary may have wished to take from this court's order was necessarily moot, in that the court's decision on the threshold issue of entitlement necessarily extinguished any downstream issue with respect to recoupment.
Yeah, the way that it would have worked is, again, being colloquial, is that what the VA would have said to the Federal Circuit is, you should say to Ms. Cornell that she loses her appeal. And if you do that, we're going to walk away and we're all happy. However, should you say that Ms. Cornell wins her appeal and therefore gets to keep the money, then we have an issue with what the Veterans Court did, which is we think it exceeded its jurisdiction in saying we can't collect from Mr. Mobley, right? Because the point would be you don't need to have that question answered unless all of a sudden Ms. Cornell can keep it. And then, at least the argument goes, if the government decided not to raise that issue with the Federal Circuit, then maybe it's just too late for you to now complain about that decision. That's the nature of what I was getting.
And as a separate point, and with respect to even, I guess, even in the context of the conditional cross appeal, I would note that, the court's written decision would necessarily subsume the bench order to the extent they both spoke to the same issue, which is the purported prohibition of the Secretary's recoupment action.
Well, it wasn't a purported prohibition.
I qualify it in that way only to the extent that, of course, the Secretary's is not agreeing with the court's ability to do that.
Well, yes, but purported suggests sort of a, you know, it was sort of unclear that maybe that was what the court was doing. I mean, I wasn't there, but I listened to the oral argument, and that seemed pretty clear.
The intent certainly was clear. I only used the word to refer to our continued objection to the court's jurisdiction in that regard.
You say continued. I'm not sure that the Secretary objected to the order at the time, right? And now that may have no legal significance, because if there's no jurisdiction to act at the time, then, as I used to tell my students when I was a professor, you know, you can be like the worst lawyer in the world and it's almost impossible to waive an objection to subject matter jurisdiction. It's really hard. But the Secretary didn't object.
No, they didn't, Your Honor. And again, it is our position that there really was no meaningful opportunity to object. Because, of course, at an appellate argument, when the court issues its, as it did here, issued its order from the bench, I'm not aware of any procedural mechanism for the Secretary to object at argument to that. Of course, any reconsideration the Secretary may have sought from the court at that point would really not be right for the court's consideration, because, of course, the issue before the court was the threshold issue of entitlement, which is likely to moot any objection.
How about, respectfully, Your Honor, we object?
That's something we could have said, Your Honor. I'm not sure that is a procedurally appropriate device for the Secretary to have relied on.
It would have preserved an objection on the record.
It would have, Your Honor. That said, it's still the Secretary's position that jurisdiction does remain in play here, and I think this court's binding precedent in Young, in Jackson, and of course the Supreme Court's decision in INS versus John clearly establishes that jurisdiction remains extant as an issue, subject matter jurisdiction remains extant as an issue until such time as the civil action itself, the integrated whole civil action, comes to an end, which it hasn't here. And ultimately, the fact that the Federal Circuit weighed in here, it strikes me as a distinction with little difference, in that in Young, this court's mandate had issued. And that is really the effect of the Federal Circuit's decision here, as it caused the finality of this court's merits decision, which is functionally identical to the court's issuance of mandate in Young, after which the jurisdictional issue remained extant in that case. And so it would seem that it remains equally extant here.
And it does seem odd, though, just as a practical matter, that right up through and including oral argument, right, all Mr. Mobley was asking was the government to say to the government, listen, this was your mistake. It was not mine. Maybe it was Ms. Cornell's mistake, too, but the one person that we know it wasn't, was me, right? And just don't hold the sword of Damocles over my head. Just tell me you won't do this. And that threat was removed by the court reaching out and taking the sword of Damocles away. And so it's hard to say in that situation that the relationship between the parties was not changed, because when the hearing, when the oral argument at Syracuse University started, Mr. Moberly faced a threat that the VA was going to take money from him. And at the end of the argument, that threat was gone. And so, I mean, it's hard to see how that didn't actually change the relationship of the parties.
And respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think it did change that relationship at all. Immediately on the heels of the board's decision here, and the obvious import of that decision was that the secretary had no authority to recoup, because the secretary's decision was that Mr. Moberly was entitled to that money. And absent any overpayment or any receipt of funds to which he's not entitled, the secretary has no recoupment authority. The agency's final decision was that Mr. Moberly is entitled to those funds that he held. He had no debt to the secretary.
But the government did not say that, right? I mean, it refused to say that. I can't remember if you argued.
I did, Your Honor. And respectfully, the secretary, speaking through myself, simply rejected Mr. Moberly's settlement offer in the context of this action. Mr. Moberly reasonably approached me and offered to walk away from this appeal in exchange for a promise that regardless of the outcome of this case, the secretary would not exercise any recoupment authority against him. And the only position the secretary ever took in that regard was to take no position.
Well, it's been a couple of weeks since I went back and listened to the oral argument. I'm fairly certain that the members of the panel asked you.
They did, Your Honor.
Right, and you said you couldn't.
Just to ease your review later, at minutes 45, 45 to 47, 54, the court did ask me several times as to what contemplation the secretary might have with respect to any future recoupment action. And my consistent answer was that the secretary had no position, and I simply was not in a position to know what the secretary might do at a future date, because that question simply wasn't ripe at that point. We were, speaking colloquially, we were at step one, and recoupment is step three or four.
And I'm with you. I'm not criticizing your response to the question, but at that moment in time, hypothetically, the veteran, who I think might have been there, I can't recall,
was, Your Honor,
right, is hearing this, thinking, holy fill in the blank, I might have to write a check for this amount of money. I know that it might be at step 10, but I'm nervous. And then the court says, under no circumstances will VA make him write a check, and he says, right? I mean, It takes a legalistic, really legalistic way to think about this, to say that at that point in time, the relationship between the VA and Mr. Moberly hasn't changed. I mean, that's just a very practical way to...
It is a practical way to look at it, and to the extent that it requires some legalistics to reach the contrary conclusion, I would note it is a legal question that we're here to answer today. And prevailing party is a legal term of art within the context of EJIA. And what we're looking for when we're looking for a prevailing party is judicial action on the merits that changes the legal action of, excuse me, the legal relationship.
So why did the VA pay, as I understand the sequence of events, there's a mistake, it's a whoops thing, right? And you pay Ms. Cornell the roughly $20,000, I think it's $20,000.
Approximately $20,000, yes.
And then Mr. Moberly submits an NOD, a disagreement with that, right?
Could you remind me which timeline you're referring to? Are you referring to the payment to Mr. Moberly or the initial payment to Ms. Cornell?
Well, Ms. Cornell pay Ms. Cornell,
yes.
Right? You pay Mr. Moberly the benefit he gets minus the attorney's fee. Right, you make that disbursement.
The disbursement to Mr. Moberly happened after the board's decision.
Okay, so let me step back and I'll tell you my bottom question. Then you help me with the timeline. At some point in time, VA made a conscious, uncoerced decision to pay this twice.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
Yes.
Because usually, under the rules of civil procedure, this would be interpleaders. Rule 22 doesn't really matter. But the point is, it's like a bank, right? Or an insurance company is a good example. They've got two people, right? The insurance policy says, pay it to my wife. Well, the question is, the wife at the time the insurance policy was issued, wife number one, or wife at the time I die, wife number two. And the insurance company's position tends to be, we don't care which one of you gets this money, in the sense that we're only paying it once, right? What the insurance company will never, under any circumstances, do is pay wife one and wife two, and then say, but, you know, we'll try to get it back from you later. But that's what you did here.
Yes, Your Honor.
What was the legal basis on which VA decided to make the payment to Mr. Moberly, the $20,000?
This court's holding in Snyder versus Principe at 15 Vet App 285. This court specifically held that whereas here the secretary has made a mistake and erroneously paid a benefit to one person while that is actually owed to another person, that erroneous payment has no effect on the correct party's entitlement. The secretary had to pay Mr. Moberly upon the board's final determination that he was entitled to that money. And just speaking to your analogy, a private insurance company is a lot different than the federal government. Of course, we're talking about veteran entitlements here, and here Mr. Moberly was determined to be entitled to that money. The secretary paid him because the secretary had to pay him. And it placed the secretary in somewhat of an unusual position in that there was only one bank of money that regrettably had been paid twice. But, of course, that's what the litigation at the merits phase here was about, was between the two people who held the money, which among them was actually entitled to keep it. And that's all that was being litigated in the merits phase here. And just speaking back to, I guess, it's Mr. Wyszynski's construction here, it's important to note what we were doing at the merits phase. Of course, when we're talking about EJA, what we're talking about is a complaint by some citizen that an unreasonable or erroneous action has been taken against him or her by the government. And then you become a prevailing party if, after that has happened, you come to a court and you receive a remedy that rights that wrong and changes the legal relationship between the two here. None of those things happened here. There is no adverse decision against Mr. Moberly anywhere. The secretary's decision was entirely favorable to Mr. Moberly. The secretary found that he was entitled to that money. And Mr. Moberly did not come to this court seeking any redress or any remedy at all. Ms. Cornell came to this court. And it's important to note that in the context of a simultaneously contested claim like we have here, the personal jurisdiction of the court is a little different. And so we have three parties instead of the more typical two. And among them, Ms. Cornell, just like Mr. Moberly, is a citizen dealing with the government. And Ms. Cornell was faced with an adverse decision by the agency. And she has rights just like Mr. Moberly does. And she simply exercised them. That's how this court became involved, by Ms. Cornell simply taking an appeal from an adverse board decision. Mr. Moberly did not come to this court seeking any sort of remedy for any judicial wrong. And it's Ms. Cornell's appeal of the adverse board decision that caused this cloud of uncertainty to hang over him. And that's regrettable, but it's simply in the nature of a simultaneously contested claim, in that one party is going to be adversely affected and the other is not. And
not all simultaneously contested claims have the fact pattern of an actual payment.
They don't.
Right.
But at the same time, Your Honor, only one party can win and necessarily the other will lose. That's in the definition of a simultaneously contested claim, in that the party's interests are mutually exclusive. One will win and one will lose. And if the one that lost takes an appeal, the certainty over the winner's victory will remain somewhat uncertain until that appeal resolves, which is all that happened here.
Is Mr. Moberly in any danger of recoupment?
At this point, no, Your Honor. There's a final...
No, ever.
No.
The secretary can't ever change his mind.
No, he cannot. There's a final decision of the board that was affirmed by this court and the Federal Circuit. Mr. Moberly is entitled to that money, and absent any debt on Mr. Moberly's part, the secretary has no authority to recoup that debt. And that, frankly, is the same situation that we had the day after, or the day that the board issued its decision here. That decision was that he is entitled to that money, and with that determination, there simply cannot be a debt.
So what are we being asked to do here? Pay Mr. Wyszynski, or authorize the payment of Mr. Wyszynski for his efforts to make sure that Mr. Moberly had repose forever from the secretary changing his mind.
Yes.
What's wrong with that? Well, why shouldn't we order him to be paid?
Because the legal relationship between the secretary and Mr. Moberly did not change. It was preserved. All that happened was this court affirmed the threshold issue of entitlement, which was the only issue before the court. The issue of recoupment never arose. It still hasn't arisen.
Yeah, but that's my point. You say it hasn't arisen. Suppose we get another secretary who says, you know, I'm going after Mr. Moberly. I don't care what Mr. Gore said to the court. I think...
well, that would be res judicata, Your Honor.
What's that?
That would be res judicata, Your Honor. That's been litigated. This court has decided, and the Federal Circuit agreed. I mean, to the extent any future secretary did make any sort of determination, just speaking colloquially here, it would go nowhere because the issue of entitlement has been decided. That is a settled issue. And that, when we're speaking about a debt, that is, like as I've mentioned before, that's simply step one. The first thing that has to happen before there can even be any relevant discussion of recoupment is there has to be a debt. The secretary's recoupment authority under 38 U.S. Code 5314 that actually requires the secretary to seek recoupment, it's necessarily predicated on the existence of a debt. In 38 U.S. Code 5302, it indicates that the first thing that must happen is the secretary has to give notice to a debtor of the existence of the debt and the amount of the debt and the available rights and remedies, and that can't happen.
What is the order that the secretary would like the court to issue after today's proceeding?
Here today would be simply a denial of the EJIA application for failure to meet the necessary elements under the EJIA.
All right, so we have the 30-day requirement has been met?
It has, Your Honor.
But the substantially justified position of the government point has not been met?
No, I would agree. The secretary has acted substantially justified here. And moreover, Mr. Moberly is not a prevailing party. But, I mean, we have spoken at length on prevailing party, and if I could, I would like to touch on the substantial justification prong here.
Mr. Gore, before you go there, let me just ask you, as I understood you to indicate that you're in the same position now as you were after the board decision.
Yes.
There's no debt. Or there was no debt, right? You discussed the requirement for having a debt as a prerequisite to recoupment, right?
Yes.
So you were not able to, however, give the intervener that assurance at the time of the merits decision, correct? Because you were waiting to see what the court said regarding what exactly?
The threshold issue of entitlement. As I mentioned, before we even reach any question of recoupment, there needs to be a debt. Before the secretary can recoup from anyone, that person has to hold money to which he or she is not entitled. And that question just simply hadn't been answered. And moreover, I would note that in Section 5314, the secretary's recoupment authority is not discretionary. It's mandatory. The statute uses the compulsory language shall. The secretary shall recoup money when there's a debt that's owed. And
well, the statute also used the word shall in the Henderson case. So who knows where that word shall
Henderson,
will end up.
Notwithstanding, Your Honor, it's not a discretionary duty on the part of the secretary.
Does the VA then provide, I should have looked closer at this, but when VA made now what you're describing as a mandatorily directed decision to pay Mr. Moberly, right? So you're saying VA had absolutely no choice. But yet, VA refused to say later, but we may come after you for that money, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
That was the position.
Right. When you paid him, did you say to him, listen, you might want to park this money in its own interest-bearing account because we may come back and we may say you got to pay us money?
To my knowledge, I have not seen any notice letter that may have gone with that payment, so I can't speak to that. My inclination is that likely no,
My inclination
but
to,
of, but
right?
Of, but of course, I would, and I would have to review the record here as well as this court's docket. I'm not certain that Ms. Cornell had yet taken an appeal from that board decision. And of course,
No, but the VA knew at that point, right, that it had paid twice.
Yes.
Right. So, I've had enough of these cases in only two years to know the one position that VA takes quite consistently is federal law doesn't allow us to pay something essentially twice when we can only pay it once, right? That's a sensible position to take in the abstract. So you knew, so VA, when I say you, I don't mean you personally, Mr. Gore, I mean,
of course,
the Department of Veterans Affairs. The Department of Veterans Affairs knew when it paid Mr. Mobley that there was a chance that he was going to be the one of the two people from which we were going to go back and get the money, right?
In the event the secretary's determination was found to be wrong,
then yes. It's absolutely true, but here's what I'm getting at, right? The VA made a choice to do something that its consistent position, at least before this court, is it can't do for long, which is pay twice when it can only pay once, right? So somebody, under the VA's view, somebody was going to have to pay that money back.
Yes.
Okay. Maybe if VA pays Mr. Mobley and says, listen, do with this what you want, but no, we may have to seek it back if it turns out that at the end of this process, Ms. Cornell is the one who should get it. Because, you know, to a lot of people, the fact that they got money suggests it's my money and I can do something with it. I can pay down my credit card bills. I can go to Tahiti. I can do whatever. Isn't it a little unfair, to use just a general term, to not tell a veteran that they're getting money that comes with a potential string because VA will not give up the right to collect from one or the other person?
Well, again, that's assuming that there wasn't any advisory to Mr. Mobley in that regard. But speaking more broadly, your hypothetical is scarcely different, really, than most any payment the secretary makes to beneficiaries. Circumstances change all the time. Sometimes there are changes in marital status, dependent status, or other changes in circumstances.
That's very different. It's true, I wouldn't suggest to the VA that they have to say, hey, if you get divorced down the road, this could change or something, right? Or, you know, right now you're getting money because you have two children, and, you know, one of your two children could be killed, and then you would only get, right, you wouldn't have to do that. But here, the VA knew. It made a conscious choice. We have written a $20,000 check to Ms. Cornell. We're now writing a $20,000 check to the veteran. The one thing we know is we can't write those two checks. Somebody's going to pay it back. It just seems to me that and if you find something, I know this is the chief judge's prerogative, but if you find something in the record that says that VA provided some notice of this to Mr. Mobley at the time they gave him the money, it'd be great to know. I haven't seen it either. But
I can say that that's not in the record because it necessarily would post-date. So that's not in the record we have here.
So it just seems to me then that at that point in time, for having not given the notice, for the secretary to now say that the position was substantially justified in saying that we won't give up the potential of recoupment just seems unfair, actually.
I certainly appreciate and I share your concerns in that regard, but of course, you have to look at, again, the context of what was happening here. The only agency position that we have with respect to this recoupment is the settlement offer sent to me by Mr. Mobley, by Mr. Mobley's counsel. And the only position the secretary has ever taken was that he can't make the guarantee that was requested. And again, that is exactly consistent with the secretary's non-discretionary duty under Section 5314.
But that way, Mr. Gore, you get it both ways. And that's kind of part of the unfairness here. On the one hand, you pay money that you indicate you mandatorily have to pay. And I would dare say there was no indication at that time that you were creating a, quote, debt from which you could recoup. And It just really
is. Respectfully, Your Honor, none of these concerns, just getting back to the threat, to the really the ultimate question that looms here today, none of these concerns create jurisdiction in the court.
Oh, my view of jurisdiction and yours are very, very different.
I have a much broader view
of our jurisdiction than you're articulating, right?
In other words, you're almost at my position.
I may be.
Respectfully, Your Honor, the issue of recoupment is a jurisdictionally distinct issue that necessarily by
right.
statute.
And I would say to you, Mr. Gore, that when we're dealing with an issue involving overpayments or double payments or any kind of payment, we have pretty broad jurisdiction.
I understand that, right. Your Honor.
And it's subject matter jurisdiction.
That's
right?
Correct. Subject matter jurisdiction. The statutes are clear. Before there can be any recoupment from anyone, for any reason, there must be a debt.
Right.
And when there's found to be a debt, the secretary is required to recoup that debt. And once that happens, assuming that that's procedurally correct, the notification and the other various requirements, there then has to be a claim for waiver of that debt. And at that point, the safety valve from Section 5314 kicks in. And that discretion to waive that debt, which really speaks to all of the issues that you're raising now, the unfairness, that is the stage at which that comes in. That is when the equities are raised. And the authority to make the initial determination of those equities is explicitly given to the secretary in the first instance.
Couldn't the secretary then to just... So I understand what you're saying. You're basically saying we're under a non-discretionary duty. We have to go back and try to collect. At step one, we have to, right, we have
that
to.
That was the point I was making with substantial justification, but we're kind of back on jurisdiction now.
Well, no, right, but it triggered something, right, which is on the substantial justification point, couldn't the secretary have said, I understand your position, we couldn't say at this point that we won't start the process, right? But couldn't the secretary have said, you know what, here's what we agree. If we have to start, I can't take that off the table because I'm under a duty to do that. However, the secretary will agree in advance that on the equities before us today, we will waive the overpayment. I mean, because at the end of the day, the secretary could have actually, had this gone south from your perspective, allowed two people to be paid once effectively by waiving the overpayment, right?
Could you ask your question once more?
Sure. Let's assume you pay Ms. Cornell, and then you pay Mr. Moberly because you have this duty to do it, right? And your position is, but you know, listen, we just can't take off the table recoupment, right? We take no position on that because that's downstream, right? That's right. What you're saying. Assume that this had come out the other way and somehow at the end of the day, some court had said, Ms. Cornell gets to keep the money. It's hers.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're at the step of creating the overpayment for Mr. Moberly, right? Mm-hmm. Couldn't, in theory, you have told the court, listen, we can't not start that process, but we will agree in advance that we will waive the debt. Because if you waived the debt, you effectively would have allowed two people to be paid twice for one thing.
With
right?
a waiver, yes.
So you could have done that, right? Couldn't you?
Theoretically, there could have been some agreement to do that. But that said, that doesn't make the secretary's decision to not do that unreasonable. I would note that, the only position the secretary ever took was to take no position. And, of course, we have to bear in mind, again, the context of what we're talking about. When we're talking about substantial justification, of course, we're talking about the secretary's administrative position. I notice my time is about to expire. I think I do have 2 minutes.
Add 5 minutes, please.
Necessarily, when we're talking about substantial justification, we have to look at the secretary's position during the administrative stage. We have absolutely no position from the secretary at the administrative stage with respect to recoupment because the only thing the board discussed in its decision was the only issue before, which was entitlement. The only time recoupment ever arose here is in the context of a settlement offer that the secretary rejected. And settlement discussions between the parties do not give rise to jurisdiction in this court. When we're talking about a decision by the agency that we're reviewing for Egypt purposes for substantial justification, we're necessarily looking for a decision. My emails to opposing counsel are not decisions of the agency. I am not a claims adjudicator. I am simply weighing a settlement offer sent to me by opposing counsel. That is not a position that we look to the substantial justification of in the context of the EJA. We're looking at agency decisions, and there has been still today no decision whatsoever on the question of recruitment, because we simply never reached it. And further note on the issue of substantial justification, the Secretary's position was precisely in line with the precedential decision of this court in Bruce versus Principe at 15 Fed 27, where that appellant asked of this court essentially the exact same thing that Mr. Moberly asked here. This court had remanded a decision of the board speaking to the question of the existence of a debt.
Which case was that, Mr.?
Bruce versus Principe, 15 Fed 27. That appellant had asked the court, on sending an issue back to the board, issue an order asking the board to cease and desist any recruitment efforts that may be underway. And this court specifically said, in the absence of a final agency decision on the issue of recruitment, it would be premature for us to reach that issue. That's exactly the situation here. They're really on the existence of recruitment as a jurisdictional issue before the court. There's no daylight between this and Bruce. The issue simply wasn't raised.
Is there any legal import to this jurisdiction question that flows from the fact that the court allowed Mr. Moberly to intervene as a party in the appeal? In other words, he became a party then in the appeal.
From subject matter, no, there's no import. From a personal jurisdiction, yes, of course, the simultaneously contested nature of the claim expanded the court's personal jurisdiction to include one more party than is typical. But the subject matter of the appeal remains the same. As in all contexts, this court's jurisdiction begins and ends with the board's decision. The issues that were jurisdictionally before the board are the issues that are jurisdictionally before this court. And
well, that's not so, is it?
It is.
What about in the context of a petition or an application to the court?
Of course, that is, of course, under the All Writs Act, ancillary to this court's statutory jurisdiction under 7252A, in that you're just simply preserving your ultimate jurisdiction to review board decisions. But ultimately, in an appeal context like we have here, we're not in a writ petition context. In an appeal situation, the court's jurisdiction is defined by statute under 7252A. And the court's jurisdiction is framed by the board's jurisdiction. And there's just no version of this where the issue of recruitment actually arose before the board, because none of the predicate events happened. First, before that issue could arise, there had to be a debt on Mr. Moberly's part. That never happened. The secretary had to start recruitment efforts. That never happened. Mr. Moberly had to submit a claim within 180 days of being notified of that debt. That never happened. There had to be a decision on that waiver. That never happened. There had to be an appeal of that. That never happened. There was no NOD. There was no statement of the case. There was no Form 9. There was no board decision. Every one of those things had to happen before this court had jurisdiction of the recruitment question, and none of them happened.
Well, Mr. Gore, that's a very nice and neat package to try to isolate and narrow what the jurisdiction would be, but it seems to me that one could make a very strong argument that the extent to which you deal with, I think I've said this before, payments or overpayments, then obviously recoupment is going to be implicated in some form or fashion.
I don't agree, Your Honor.
I didn't think you
would. No, but I mean, the necessary implication of that construction is that the issue of recoupment is necessarily wrapped up in the question of entitlement. And by statute, Your Honor, that's just not so. Section 5302 makes that clear, in that before you get to the issue of waiver, which ultimately is what we're talking about with recoupment here because entitlement's been settled, 5302 makes clear that before recoupment arises as a jurisdictionally appropriate issue, there has to be a claim within 180 days of notification. That just did not happen for the simple reason that we hadn't settled the question of entitlement yet. And I see I am about to expire here. Would the court...
Would you like more time?
I could do this all day, Your Honor. Whether you want me to is another question.
Right. But if you'd like to summarize, you may.
I will summarize. Again, Your Honor, just to sum up, the court's determination initially was made without jurisdiction. And to the extent there was jurisdiction, it did not change the legal relationship of the parties, because at no time has the secretary had any authority to recoup from Mr. Moberly. And moreover, the secretary's position to simply not cross the recoupment bridge until he reached that bridge was entirely reasonable and substantially justified. And for each of those reasons independently, and of course altogether, Mr. Mobley is not entitled to an EJA award here, and the court should deny his application for one.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Rosinski, you have 10 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor. I initially want to take some challenge to the Secretary's position that he did not take a position regarding recoupment. As stated in the intervener's brief on page 3, footnote 2, a communication between us, they stated that the Secretary, quote, cannot extend any guarantees that Mr. Moberly's payment will not be the subject of recoupment efforts, end quote, because, quote, as long as the question of Ms. Cornell's entitlement to her fee remains open, the propriety of Mr. Moberly's continued receipt of the same funds remains open as well. So that is the issue in a nutshell. It remains open. They wouldn't agree to close that issue. The court closed that issue.
But he didn't say that Mr. Mobley owed the money back. He basically said they didn't take a position. And if it remained open, isn't that consistent?
I read that as if you wanted, you have to go to the court because we're not going to do it, which is fine. That's their position. I don't understand.
No, but does that mean that you took that position and then you're here saying it cost Mr. Moberly X amount of dollars in the form of your fee to get repose, which we now hear from the Secretary he has?
I believe so, Your Honor. What we're saying is that...
So I'm going to ask you again, what's the order you want us to enter? We've heard what the government wants.
The order is that the that to award the EJA amount application as submitted, because the Secretary has conceded timeliness and the reasonableness of the funds, and that the Secretary was not substantially justified because of all these back and forths and the refusal to settle this out of court, as it were, and force the litigation that resulted in the change in the legal relationship between Mr. Moberly and the Secretary, and that he was a prevailing party because of it. So those are the two remaining issues, and that the jurisdictional issue goes back to Nevada, U.S. v. Nevada, which I think is worth reading the operative section. Simply put, the doctrine of res judicata provides that when a final judgment has been entered on the merits of a case, quote, it is finality as to the claim or demand in controversy, concluding parties, and those in privity with them, not only as to every matter which was offered and received to sustain or defeat the claim or demand, but as to any other admissible matter which might have been offered for that purpose. The final, quote, judgment puts an end to the cause of action, which cannot again be brought into litigation between the parties upon any ground whatever, end quote, citing other Supreme Court cases. And that,
so what about the, what's your response to Mr. Gore's argument that the, just my characterization now, that the dependency of the EJA application has not, you know, allowed the last chapter of the book to be closed such that Nevada, the rule from Nevada applies?
I believe there's no support for that. All the citations that I have seen and have provided state exactly the opposite. And indeed, that brings the Hensley case. A request for attorney's fees should not result in a second major litigation. And that's cited in Gene as well, all citing Hensley, and that's what the proposition Hensley stands for. This isn't supposed to happen. It's not a relitigation. This court's cases have used that term, no relitigation in EJA.
So I'm with you on that point. That was an issue I think that we dealt with a little bit in the Dixon case, which I actually think was exactly the same panel as I look at my colleagues up here. But is it different to say we're not going to allow a wholesale relitigation, right?
That's one thing, right? And I think everybody's going to agree with that. Is it different when the issue we're talking about is subject matter jurisdiction? Because as I was saying to Mr. Gore, you know, sort of half humorously, it's you got to be a really bad lawyer to get rid of a jurisdictional objection. And it can happen. But if, in fact, this is still alive in some respect, is that different than just relitigating a merits question?
I can't do any better than the justices in Nevada. The final judgment puts an end to the cause of action, which cannot be brought into litigation between the parties on any grounds whatsoever. Whether EJ is a cause of action or a grounds, I don't know how you get past that. And there's multitudes of cases that say this is not a relitigation. And if you're going to go to the jurisdiction of the merits panel, that's I don't know how else you define it. You're relitigating the key issue of the case.
So your position is, based on Nevada and maybe other cases as well, that once the Federal Circuit decided, basically the civil action ended, but for attorney fee application.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe this is a separate application by definition. You have to separately apply for this, and it even gets a different number. It gets an E after it. It's a separate issue, a separate litigation based on separate statutes and separate case law. Indeed, that's in Dillon v. Brown, another one of these court cases back all the way to 1995, quote, the appellant would now have the court reach back and, in essence, re-adjudicate the appeal de novo. However, the Supreme Court has admonished, quote, a request for attorney's fees should not result in a second major litigation, citing Hensley and other cases. So in that case, I said it cited only a certain error, but that doesn't change the fact that the case is closed and that you don't re-litigate it under EJA. The way I read these cases, it would be a major change for this court to say that we didn't have jurisdiction back then. And then I propose to you, then what happens to that case? Does it unwind all the way back to the Federal Circuit? Because the Secretary did not appeal this issue. So how does that impact everything else? And that's one of the reasons I believe underneath all this case law. Done is done. You had lots of opportunities to appeal it, raise it, maybe more sophisticated at the Federal Circuit, but certainly before this court, so they could have asked for reconsideration. They could have done a lot of things to try to flesh this out. But to keep throwing it into the EJA pile is just, there's just no authority for you to hear that.
So, Mr. Rosinski, how is Mr. Moberly a prevailing party if the government won at the board level, the government won at the court, and the Federal Circuit affirmed?
Because as I started out, Mr. Moberly had a very narrow issue before the court. He didn't have issues with, he wasn't involved in the litigation between Ms. Cornell and the secretary as far as her eligibility. He had his money and he wanted to protect it. As a matter of fact, one way of looking at what I've been saying before is that at the time of the hearing, he had no debt. What we were asking for, in other words, was for the secretary not to create a debt after this hearing. So that's the point at which you do enter into all this waiver talk. But it's the same thing. If you waive it now, if you're going to waive it later, why don't you waive it now and save the government? And, you know, we're supposed to be saving the government fisc here. Well, that would have saved a whole lot of it right there.
But it sounds like that the possibility of a debt was created when he was paid.
Well, absolutely. And that's one of the ways of viewing it. At least once there was a debt. He had the money. He wanted to keep it. However you phrase it, that they're leaning on, well, there was no debt created. That's what we're saying. Please don't create a debt later on, because we've already been through that. And then where do we circle around again? We're told to talk to Cornell. And you go back and forth that way. All of that was what went away when we walked out of that that hearing.
Let me ask you this. We keep coming back to the same thing, or at least I do. If the secretary had said at some time during the, shall we call it, the fundamental merits determination. We promise never to get to step 9 or 8 or 7, let alone step 1 of this recruitment process. Put it in writing. We, the secretary, the department, are aware of our statutory obligations, but we're either reading it to be consistent with what we think is a just result or whatever. They never said that. And so isn't it your position that for you to get to the point that today the secretary says we're never coming after Mr. Moberly again, ever? They didn't, having never said that until you got here today.
Absolutely.
That's what causes, in a separate proceeding, your entitlement, because you filed it within 30 days, and their failure to say that was not the substantially justified position.
I believe that is.
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but that's what it sounds like to me.
I believe the EJ application, as we said, should be treated as the same as every other party's and evaluated on the same criteria, that we meet all the criteria for all the reasons we've all discussed here. The secretary's discussion about reaching back and changing things is just not relevant or not authorized for the court to do that. And particularly because, for reasons that are well known, the panel's different. And even if you wanted to go back, what do we do? I mean, it's just not practical. As well as legally, they had opportunities. Somewhere down here, there's discretion. Wherever the chain of events can be broken by the secretary saying, I give up my discretion, I'm not going to do it. And that's all we were asking for. And this all lays into the threat. If you look at it, it's the threat of what was actually going to potentially happen. Sometimes it's worse.
Do you think the threat has been removed?
I think I heard it be removed right
today.
Today, yes.
Well, had you ever heard something that you considered to be removal of the threat before today?
No, Your Honor. Just the last I heard it was in the written order on the merits.
Okay. Your time has expired.
If I may, I want to again apologize to the court for any discomfort I caused or upset I caused this morning, and particularly to you, Judge Allen. I didn't. I was trying to think, and maybe I gave you that impression, but I meant no harm. It wasn't a game. I was just trying to be helpful, and I will not do that again.
Thank you, Mr. Rosensky. This case is submitted for consideration. The court will now come down and recounsel.